We have any Al-Anons here?
Yeah.
Do we? Good, because I'd be remiss if I didn't start on that. Because I'm one of these people in AA that happens to believe that we wouldn't be half the organization that we are if it wasn't for the program of Al-Anon. I really and truly believe that. Thank you. That's enough, though. We'll don't ever give an Al-Anon or a new man too many attaboys. They get so they expect it. No, really, I'm sincere about that. Hal Dean, a lot of you might have known Hal, beautiful man, Elise's husband, who died some years ago, once told me after I'd been sober for a little while, he says, what are you going to do with your life now, Bill? And I said, well, I don't know if I can help a drunk or try to do what I can, Hal. He said, well, try to stamp out some of the ignorance that exists in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I says, ignorance? And he says, yes. And of course, I didn't understand what he meant, but I had too much pride to ask him. And I found out over the years what he's talking about, and it is such things as Al-Anon. A lot of us are awful ignorant of Al-Anon and the benefits that we can derive from it by introducing the new family to an Al-Anon member or having it established in one way or another. And especially if you're sponsoring a new man and he has a wife or spouse, rather, I think we're awfully remiss if we don't try to make that connection for him. Because it certainly helps when both of them are in the same kind of a growth program. And besides that, if you're sponsoring a man especially, you'll miss about, I'd say about 74 or 75% of the lies he's going to tell. He won't be able to tell them anymore, you know. But really, and if you're worried about what Al-Anon does, you know in AA we tell you, we teach you how to move the buttons so she can't push them anymore. Well, in Al-Anon they tell them where the buttons move to. There was this judge, and unbeknownst to him, she'd been going to some of them Al-Anon meetings. And he, like me, was a periodic and a puker. And he called her from the office, and he says, honey, he says, have a quick supper tonight for me. He says, I've got to go over some transcripts and render a decision in the morning, first thing. And she said, okay. She figured he's lying. But anyhow, she had a little light supper for him. He took off for his beer joint, you know. And along in the evening, like I say, he puked and one thing and another. And finally, he's driving home, and he says, my problem is not getting in tonight. She's a pretty sound sleeper. But he says, I must get out tomorrow before she gets to me, because if tomorrow even, I'll come up with something about being out and all. So anyhow, he got in all right. The next morning, he made it all the way down to the front door, and she caught him and gave him that Al-Anon handshake and says, my God, what did you do last night? And he said, what do you mean? She said, well, there's vomit all over your jacket and vest. He said, some drunk did that to me. And says, when he comes before me this morning, I'm going to give him 60 days. She says, you better give him 90 days. He did something in your pants, too. So don't think they don't sharpen up in those Al-Anon rooms. Boys, they do. John Henry owned a small dairy farm. And every now and then, he'd go to the local auction and buy him a milk calf. It was a good one, you know, when he needed it. So he was known over at the auction and everything. And so one Wednesday evening, he was going over to the auction to look at a cow. And as he walked in, well, the auctioneer said, John Henry, you ought to get that cow right there. She'll give you 40 pounds of milk a day. And John poked on the cow and made her turn around and everything. And so he looked back up at the auctioneer and he says, Barry, this damn cow is blind. He said, well, what do you want her to do, read or give milk? You might say, well, what in the heck has that got to do with AA? It's got an awful lot to do with AA people, because I'm of the opinion that we're sort of losing track of where we're going, and we need to know exactly where it is and what we're about anymore. We've gotten sort of astray. We sort of cover up things anymore and dilute them and make them weaker than they really are and present them in manners in which they weren't supposed to be presented. Margaret Stancher was a sociologist who died in the 60s. And she was up in New York doing some work. And she ran into a young boy that was on crutches. And you could just see the bitterness in him and the hatred and all. So she had to inquire about him. She found out he'd been playing stickball out in the street. And he'd gotten hit and broke his legs. And they took him to an old drunk doctor up on the corner. And he just sort of patched him up about halfway. And the kid had been on crutches ever since then. And that's what was the cause of his bitterness. Well, she knew a surgeon, so she called him and asked him if he would do her a favor and look at this kid and see if something could be done for him. So it was agreed to. She took him over to the surgeon. He examined him. He said, "Oh, yeah, I've just got a rebreak. It's no sense in this boy being on crutches." So sure enough, the deal was done and everything, and the boy was on crutches for about a year, and then finally he could walk without them. So she asked the audience, "Do you know where he is at today?" And they all offered different things, school, whatever, you know. And she says, "No, he's in prison." Because you see, the surgeon and the therapist and even myself all contributed to teaching him to walk again. But we didn't teach him where to walk. And that's what we're doing in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous anymore, ladies and gentlemen. I'm sort of scared of it, to tell you the truth. I hear some things that I just are completely foreign to this program. I don't hear it up here, but I sure hear it in some of the places that I go. Anyhow, my name's Bill Oakley, and I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date is July 70, and that by the grace of God and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. My home group is the By the Book group in Orlando, which I go to every Tuesday night. And they send you their greetings and salutations, prayers for continued sobriety from all the winos and winettes of that group. We'd like to see y'all. If you're ever down there, it's the best group in Orlando. Stop and visit with us. We'd be glad to have you. A little different than most meetings, but I'm quite sure you would enjoy it. I better go on and get drunk and undrunk, I guess, you know. There's some fairly new people here. I better put that pitch in. I've been trying to do this for the last couple of years or so. And there's a lot of young people up here. And I don't see a lot of young people out here making these talks and these leads. And that's of great concern to me because, by golly, we need you. We really and truly need young people. These old graybeards have been getting up here for so long, and everybody's heard their story and everything. We need some fresh bloods up at these podiums. And I know some of you are probably thinking, "Oh, my God, I couldn't possibly get up and talk to a bunch of people or anything like that." Well, it's real easy in AA. We make it easy for you, in fact. You can start off at your home group where you know everybody. You know, so you feel sort of comfortable and everything, and you make your first lead. And remember this, nobody knows any more about the subject than you do. You're an authority on you, so you know the subject matter. And always go to the bathroom before you get up here. I don't care what anybody tells you, whether you just went, get up, go again, because if something biologically or physiologically happens to you after you get up here and you have to go to the bathroom, then you think about that and you think about what you're going to talk. Pardon me. And they called us the nodders in AA. Because you just get up and say something. Well, some probably you've been to a meeting and somebody said something. You say, "Man, I don't think I'd have said that." And you'll see somebody. I know this is true because I was at Central one time and sitting next to a very dear friend of ours. And a visitor was making some dissertation on the subject. And she says, "And I peed in my purse." And I said, "Geez, I don't think I'd have said that." And I started to put my head down. I looked at my friend. She was... So then you just pick you out a nodder, and you just go on talk to your nodder, and it'll go off all right. Only thing you got to remember in an AA talk is when you're through, you're through. If it ain't but a 20-minute talk, we'll accept that. But don't take 20 minutes and try to drag it to an hour. We don't like that too much. So start making these talks and get up here and get some of these other guys out of the way here, because we do need you. You got a lot of good experience and a lot of good things to say, and we got a lot of young people coming into the rooms, and we need you badly. We certainly do. Thank you for that. So again, I better go on and get drunk and undrunk. The other thing I want to say is that, you know, the dots have to connect, you know, if you make the pictures on those little things that you had as children, you know, one dot to the next, you know, and all that sort of thing. Well, you can forget that in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. That don't necessarily have to work here because we got a silent influence that comes into our lives and the dots don't mean a darn thing. I would like to think of a time in my own life, and that's sort of going to keep me honest tonight too, incidentally. As I came out of jail in 1970, I was in jail first. I was washing cars downtown Orlando, the police cars. That was my job. And, of course, I'd steal everything out of them, the change that dropped out of their pocket, candy bars that they left in there, newspapers, magazines. Some of them even had some booze in there. You didn't know that policemen drank, but some of them do. But I'd already made up my mind I wasn't a fool of that stuff anymore, but I'd steal everything else I could get my hands on. And then I'd take it out at night, and I'd read it to the 16 other members of my tank there. And so this one day I got the paper, and it says, "Drunk jurist goes to jail." And I says, I ran on and read the thing, and it says, "Marion Benbrook, Manosas Avenue, so forth and so on." And sure enough, this guy had appeared for jury duty, and the bailiff got a good whiff of him, and he said, "My God, this man's drunk." And he went and told the judge, and the judge sent him to jail right from jury duty. Well, I didn't know at the time. I read it and thought it was pretty funny. Everybody else did out there, you know. And sure enough, when I got out of jail, he was one of the first people I met. And we were partners in a business that we built up for the next 5 or 6 years, you know. So you don't know how these things are going to turn out. Marion, stand up out there, buddy. There's my boy. Yeah. And that's his adult supervisor with him, too. Why don't he stand up and say hello? Anyhow, don't plan on everything just going. It's like the one Jewish expression I like, man thinks and God laughs, huh? That's about the way it is in AA. So, poor student, came from a poor town, poor people, poor home. Everything else was poor about it, I guess. Neighborhood, the whole thing. I was told to go on and quit school. It wasn't doing any good, and I was supposed to go to work and try to make some kind of financial contribution to this destitute family. So I went to work in a stockyard. Had never been around stock before. It was in Lexington, Kentucky. And it was winter time, cold and miserable as it can possibly be in Kentucky. And they put me on the hog scales. Hogs normally have one spot that they go to. They're ready. They do this on a regular basis. They don't try to litter up the whole pen. But when they're on the road like that and everybody's whistling at them, beating with canes and one thing or another, they go wherever they want to, and they go frequently. And I was standing in that awful stuff, and I was poorly shod for that kind of work, clothed too. I wasn't going to have heavy clothes or anything. And so I was standing in that awful stuff. My feet were all wet, and I was sick and just miserable, you know, as a person could possibly be. And no farmer sensed my predicament. He walked over there, and he reached down in them bib overalls, and he took out a bottle, and he says, "Here, boy." He says, "You take yourself a drink of this, and you'll be all right." And I did. And Lord God, did he tell the truth. Lord God, did he tell the truth. Because right away, it didn't do just like a little sip, make me a little warm or something like that. It went to every part of my body. I didn't care what I was standing in anymore. It didn't make any difference. You know, I wasn't afraid anymore. I took that cane, just knocked the hell out of the next hog that come by, just show him I'd do it. I had 10 cents in my pocket. It became $10. And I got prettier. Yeah. Got prettier. Right there on that hog scales in Lexington, Kentucky. And that's when my golden moment was born. Because from that date on, from that time on, any time that golden moment came to Bill Oakley's mind, he was destined to drink. It didn't make any difference where I was at. Don't tell me about the consequences of anything. That had nothing to do with it. When that golden moment came on, I would drink. As a consequence of that, I've had many jobs, because jobs don't mean anything. Didn't mean anything to me when that golden moment. I would walk off, that's all. Whether they owed me money or didn't, that had nothing to do with it. Whether I was going to get arrested, that had nothing to do with it. I would drink. World War II was going on. I finally became of age and got in, and which was the popular thing to do in World War II if you had two arms and two legs and two eyes. And I went in armored infantry. Those are the people that walk behind the tanks. They don't ride on them. And I didn't have any problems for a while. It might have been the regimentation of that. I don't know. But the golden moment didn't bother me for that period of time. The war was over in Europe, and they started discharging everybody, and they finally got down to the crud like me. And they asked me, would I like to get out of the military? And I'd learned one thing in the Army. I didn't want to be all I could be. So offered that opportunity, I got out. And spent the next 5 years doing what street drunks normally do. You know, going to jail and getting their head beat in and all that sort of thing. And on the skids and all that. Those 5 years, I finally came to in a car in Detroit. And I don't know whose car, it was just parked there. It was convenient, so I slept in it, I guess, or passed out in it. And I came to, and I says, "My God, I didn't have any money. I'd been on a wine drunk." You know, have you ever been on about a 3-week wine drunk? It like Charlie said, when you puke, you have to cut it with scissors. Well, that's what I'd been on. And I didn't have a drink, and I didn't have any money to buy one. I didn't even know what part of town I was in. And I thought, oh, my gosh. And the jumps were about to set in. I'd had the shakes when I woke up, and they were going into the jumps right quick-like. But anyhow, I looked over there, and there was a sign. It says, "Uncle Sam needs you." And I remember talking to some winos the night before, and they were talking about this Korean thing. So I convinced myself that that's what I needed to do. You know, it was my patriotic duty to go in the military, being this Korean thing was going to be going on. I know now, and of course I probably knew then that patriotism didn't have anything to do with it. I wanted to go somewhere where I could get in and out of the cold, and they'd give me some clothes, a little dad of money, and feed me, and more or less condone my kind of behavior. So I went down, and sure enough, they took me in the Air Force. And of course, I took my golden moment with me. We went to Korea quite early in that thing, and the example of how often and frequent this golden moment would take over my life is I made 14 stripes during the Korean War and came home with three of them. So you see, every time the golden moment, don't tell me there's a war going on. I got nothing to do with it. I got busted on a ship going over there for making wine. But every time that golden moment would come on, I'd get busted, you know. When I sober up, I'd do a good job and the old man would give them back to me. So that was the whole story of my life, it seemed like, in the military. I got home from there. I was 27 years old. I'm a full-blown alcoholic because I'm a blackout drinker. And if you're a blackout drinker, don't worry about it. You is. So the committee got together. You know how the committee gets up here and gets its, you know, back and forth like a bunch of magpies? And I determined there's something wrong with my life, and I needed to do something about it. I couldn't quite figure out what it was. And it dawned on me that perhaps what I needed to do was get married. Sobriety through sex. Because you can take this one to the bank. There can be no love in the active addiction. Mm-mm. The love is to the addiction, you know. But anyhow, I found a girl down there in Kentucky, and she had two wee children, and we got married. And my next assignment was down at Miami International Airport on 36th Street. It was stabilized 2 or 3 years. It was a country club of the Air Force at the time. It was 216 of us down there, and all 216, including the chaplain, were drunks. So that's where I was sent. And when I arrived there, I found out that you only had to work 2 days a week, 2 days a month down there. That's when you trained your reservists. It was imperative that you work those 2 days, though. Everybody knew that you had to be on for those 2 days. No question about it. But you see, one night I decided that golden moment says, well, you can tell them that you're coming in late. You can call them and tell them you'll be in at 9 or something like that. And then, of course, you'll call them and tell them, come in noon. Tell them you'll be in there at noon. You're getting your car fixed. And then, of course, it was, don't call them at all. Somebody will cover for you. Well, I took a reduction for that drunk, and it cost me $55 a month for 6 years. You would think, at the low rank that I was anyhow, that $55 a month, I'd say, my God, this is really going to hurt my family. I didn't even think about that. My thought was, my God, I use $55 a month in chit books over at the club. I had no interest in that family. Absolutely none. That's why I say there can be no love in the active addiction. It goes to the addiction. The tour was over down there after many scrapes, and I went to Tendon Bar, of course. That's what most alcoholics would do, you know. That helped me a bunch, especially with no work to do and all that sort of thing. But anyhow, that was finally over with, and I was assigned to the Isle of Crete off the coast of Greece, and arrived there 18 days late because I'd been on another drunk all across the world. But was going to start anew. You know how when we get to thinking every now and then, I need to start anew? Well, that's what I was going to do in Crete. I was going to start anew, except when I got there, I found out I'd been 18 days getting there, and the old man took a very dim view of that. And so I was already in trouble instead of having a clean slate to go with. But here's what the periodic can do. Those of you who are periodics, about 40% of you are, I imagine. For the next 18 months, with the keys to that NCO club in my pocket, I could have had a drink around the clock. Wouldn't cost me a nickel. I didn't touch a drop. And you can imagine what's going on at home. The first month or so, she says, he's done this before. You know, he's done this before. He'll come off of it. God knows when, but he'll do it again. He'll come off of it. Then it was 2 months, 3 months, 6 months. And I remembered all the birthdays and the Christmases and sent all the nice gifts and all that. Sent all my money home, you know, and all, more than what I had in an Air Force check. I sent my paycheck from the club because it wasn't needed either. So as you can see, after about 6 or 8 months, the tone of her letters, how they're changing, you know. My God, maybe this is the time. Maybe he's finally off of that damn stuff. And so finally the year and a half was up. We had a home in Georgetown, Kentucky at that time, and Georgetown was dry. The closest booze was over in Fayette County, where Lexington's at. We only had the one car, so when I'd get up early in the morning, I could take the car and go over towards Lexington and stop at the first beer joint and have a couple of beers, but I'd have to take the car back because they'd need it for something. So I couldn't do any golden moment drinking, you know. In fact, I didn't even consider it drinking. But imagine how surprised I was. 27 days later, I'm in Straps Air Force Base down at Shaw Air Force, South Carolina. They kept me in Straps for 9 days, wheelchair two weeks, and 30 more days before they could return me to duty. And I was absolutely baffled by this. How in the world could this be? I've been working out on the beach. I hadn't had a drink in 18 months. I was in the best physical shape I've been in years. I couldn't understand how I could be back in them damn straps again. I had to come to a room full of drunks, and you all told me what it was all about. The disease progresses in me whether I drink the stuff or not. I'm thoroughly convinced of that today. You don't have to offer me anything along that line. I'm thoroughly convinced of that. The career kept going like that, naturally. When the golden moment would come on, I'd go drink. It didn't make any difference what the practice might have been or what deal we might have been on or episode. Until finally I was in real deep doo-doo, and the only way to get out of it was go to NAM. So I volunteered for NAM. That shows you some of my insanities, because I was too old and had enough time. I really wouldn't have had to have gone, I don't guess. But anyhow, I went to NAM. But you see, I took that golden moment with me. And again, I ended up in another funny palace. And this is one of the worst ones I've ever been in, because some of them kids coming out of the bush had reason to be scared. You know, they'd been through an awful lot. And of course, I was just drunk. And Charlie started sending in some stuff about that time, and that ward went absolutely crazy. Them kids were under beds on the roof, and the nurse was chasing them around with jackets and needles and trying to get them strapped down in beds and all this sort of thing. And that's when I came to. I said, Lord God, what am I doing in this darn place? And there was a chief of nurses was a male major. And he looked down at me and he says, you're here because by God, you belong here. And I never thought of that that way. I held that, though, for an awful long time after he said it. That was finally over with, though. It continued just like that. It didn't make any difference if there was war going on. It had nothing to do with that. Just something else. It was separate from me. It was over, though, and I went up to Selfridge Air Force Base to be retired. And only had a few months to do then. And they already made up my medical histories and all that sort of thing so they could go on and retire me. And I was called in. I went to the office one morning, and the kid says, the old man wants to see you. Well, again, I've been on a pretty good one this time. I haven't been off of this drunk, I don't guess, in the last 6 or 8 weeks. And I'm just passing out and coming to, you know. Passing out and coming to is all I'm doing. And going out to drink 2 and 3 o'clock in the morning, having 2 or 3 drinks, and then having to make it home back to bed, you know. And anyhow, I walked into the office, and the kid says, Sergeant O'Man wants to see you. I'd known this colonel before, and he was one of those rarities in the military. He was a man who would do what he said he would do, and he was known for that. So anyhow, I went up to this colonel's office and told his secretary I was to see him. She says, yeah, he's waiting on you. So I went in and threw him a rather shaky highball, you know, and he started chewing, and he chewed on me pretty good, 10 or 15 minutes. And his final remark at me was, Sergeant Oakley, I want you to leave my office and go down there and run your office as Sergeant of the United States Air Force till the very day you're relieved of duty. If you do not do it, I will jerk those stripes off of your arm and kick you out of this man's Air Force. You understand me? And I said, yes, Colonel, I understand you. Dismissed, and I threw him another highball. And as I was going out through his secretary's office, that golden moment came on. And I got in that truck and drove straight off that bar as if that man hadn't spoken to me. It didn't mean nothing to me that what that man would do to me. I knew he would do it. I was fully aware of the fact that he would do exactly what he said. And I was willing to give 19 and 8 at that time for a drink of alcohol. But you see, that golden moment was more important, what that colonel had to say. It was more important, that retirement. Only by the grace of God, I don't even know that God had a lot to do with it. Anyhow, somebody covered for me. And I finally made it to a retirement. Having no place else to go, being that wife was fed up with me after 16 years, I came to Orlando because I liked the warm weather and started putting it together again. Again, that's the story of the periodic alcoholic. He can put it together again that quick and then tear it down that quick, too. He don't know when it's going to happen. That's the tragic part about it. He can bring home the paycheck for 6 months in a row, and then all of a sudden, boop, he don't come home. I mean, you wonder what happened to him. He got drunk. So we have that ability to put it together and put it together in a hurry, too. And so I got down here and I found a small job. Didn't take a lot. Had a small retirement coming. And I put it together. And one evening it went something like this. I stopped down there in Pine Castle and I had a beer. And that's the only one I drank. Set the glass down. The guy said, nope, don't want another one. That's enough. And the next day, I patted myself on the back. I like broke my arm doing it. See, there I had the answer to this thing. I drank that beer last night. I'm not drunk. I didn't get drunk last night. You know? That's the answer to that thing. So sure enough, I tried it the next night. Drank one beer. Said, man, this is it. I got it. After all these years, I know the answer to this thing. Then it was Friday night. And the committee was something like this. I like shooting pool with these old boys. I've already paid the rent, so I don't even need to see the landlord. Done the laundry yesterday. I can send next door for some chicken. I don't have to go home and cook. I don't know how long that drunk lasted. The only thing I'm sure of in that drunk is I'm standing down 9:30, 10 o'clock in the morning in the center of Orlando, either at Central or Pine or one of those major cross streets there. Sun beaming down, of course, and I'm standing on the curb with tears pouring down my eyes because I couldn't tell you for the love of God how to get off of that curb. I did not know how to get off of that curb. I didn't know whether a helicopter was going to come down and get me, somebody was going to put me on a tractor and carry me off or escort me in a stretcher. I could not get off of that curb. And when I came to in jail, I was, a guy asked me, he says, you know how long you've been here? And I said, got here last night, didn't I? He said, you've been here 5 days. I said, 5 days? He said, yeah. That's, isn't it a shame? 5 days just taking out of your life you don't know nothing about. But then after I was able to think about that, I was glad I'd been in jail. Because I know some of the horror stories. I've been to Rayford and heard them stories of what those guys do in blackouts, you know. And I know I'm equally capable of doing some of those things. We might think we would not, but we can do some real strange things in a blackout. And we have some records of them. A doctor doing the C-section and not knowing it. And coming in the hospital the next day and raising hell with everybody because somebody messed with his patient. He did it in a blackout. People have flown airplanes and murder, everything you can think of. Anyhow, after thinking about that, I was glad that I'd been in jail for 5 days so I couldn't have been out there to hurt anybody. And so, of course, that's where I started washing the cars, and that's where I read about Marion. And I built the 47 days that time because that's the old pea farm that used to be in Orlando. And unlike the jails today, when you go in there, you went to work. I don't care who you was. If you say, well, I don't know anything about chickens. Well, that's good. You went out and run the chicken ranch for them or raised beef or picked okra. That was a favorite thing. Because that's what you got to eat there was okra and grits. And the okra turned black on you overnight, you know. Anyhow, everybody went to work. And so I thought, well, after I had a trustee to watch over me all the time when I was downtown, he didn't watch over me all the time, but I knew where he was at. I could go and get him. Anyhow, I said, well, wait a minute. I had a little piece of change in the bank and all that before I started this drunk. Let me just go up here. The bank's on the next corner. Let me go up there and just get me some money and get out of this darn thing. And so I asked Mr. Red if he'd take me up there at noon. He said, yeah, I'd be glad to. And so I walked up there and I told the lady, I said, don't have my account number, don't have nothing. But I gave her my name and address and all that sort of thing. And I told her that I needed some money so I could bail out of jail. And she was gone for a few minutes. She came back and she says, Mr. Oakley, not only is your account depleted, but there's 12 pieces of paper for which you have no funds. I said, oh, my God. That's the first time I've ever hung paper in my life. I never hung a piece of paper. I've done everything else in the world for a drink, but I never hung paper. So now not only was in jail, but I had 12 pieces of paper to worry about. And this is part of where the dots, you don't have to worry about how they connect or not in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had another little meeting with myself, and it went something like this. This is the only one I had at that particular time, up until that time, that had any validity at all. And I said to myself, Bill Oakley, for God's sakes, quit telling yourself you can drink alcohol. You can't drink it. I don't care where you drink it, when you drink it, how you drink it, who you drink it with. Where it has nothing to do with when you drink alcohol, you get in trouble. Look at you right now. You're in another damn jail. You know, your life's a piece of garbage. Quit telling yourself you can drink alcohol. You can't. And silently I said, God help me. I never want to be like this again in my life. I don't care what goes down. I never want to be like this again in my life. And some guy walked up to the jail cell. Never seen him before. And them 16 guys in there, I'm the only one he pointed at. And he said, boy, would you like to do something about your drinking problem? And I said, yes, sir. I had that moment of truth. And I said, yes, sir, I would. And silently, I reiterated that prayer. God help me, I never want to be like this again in my life. And a strange thing happened to that jail cell. I was given a second golden moment, much more powerful than the first one I ever think about being. And that man came and he talked to us every night that any of us would want to go and listen to about AA. This man was as close to an atheist as anybody I've ever met in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, which wasn't necessary because he brought me a message of hope, and that's what I really needed. He didn't bring a spiritual message at all. And I don't know what that might be, the best message to carry to the jails. But anyhow, I listened to him until that time was over, and I was glad to have listened to him. And he told me, he says, first day you're out of jail, you go to a meeting. And of course, I had a million excuses not to go to a meeting. Incidentally, by his instructions, I bought up 11 of those 12 pieces of paper while I was still in jail. Some wino would be getting out, you know, and I give him $2 because I'd come into a little piece of change. And I give him $2 and I tell him to go to so-and-so's bar and ask if they knew me. And they, of course they would. Yeah, we'd like to get a hold of him. We got 2 or 3 pieces of his paper here. And so I'd send them the money. When I got out, I had 1 check outstanding. The American Legion had it. And they called me about a year later when they was having a membership drive. And I went down and got the last piece of paper. So by following his instructions early in the game, I was able to do something even from a jail cell that I didn't think I'd be able to do. Anyhow, I followed his instructions. And I went to a meeting down at the Old Central Group. Old Central was a cross section, one of the best cross sections of alcoholics. We had the whole spectrum of alcoholics there. You know, all the street drunks just about went there. Women were only there usually at noon. They wouldn't come down there at night, no, because it was a bad district and all, considered bad. But they had some strong people there. It was a good group because they believed in the steps. We had a couple of problems. We had so many insurance salesmen around there, we made them wear badges so they'd quit trying to sell insurance to each other. And Ben and I was right in with them because if there's anything pitiful in the ruins of Alcoholics Anonymous, it's to see a fresh drunk with a business card. Here, take my card. You just gave me. Well, take another one, you know. Anyhow, I went to the Old Central Group and started on this road to some kind of a sobriety. And, of course, Ben and I had no... He had the outside of the house. The wife had just taken the inside. And I had a truck that was impounded. He had a driver's license, and I didn't have a driver's license. And neither one of us had any money. And we determined we had to make some money somehow. So we got a mop out of somebody's trash pile and a broken ladder. And boy, paid $5 for a vacuum cleaner, used vacuum cleaner. And we started cleaning furnaces in mobile homes. $8 a pop. Can't clean too many a day, but anyhow, that's the way we started. When we finished, about 5 years later, we had 2 trucks and all the tools. We set up screen rooms. We could do the whole thing. But that's where we started, you know. And of course, we both continued in AA and had a lot of fun with it along the way, too. But this group, the Central Group at that time, was such a mixture of people. We had people there with, we had more degrees around there than any group I've ever been in since. They had people down there that had so many hyphens and initials behind their names. People that taught math at the University of Georgia and California and places like that, you know, were packing boxes over in Sanford for $4 an hour, trying to get a new start in life and all that. But anyhow, I'm one of these people that happens to believe that, you know, they talk about bottom. High bottom, wide bottom, skinny bottom, narrow bottoms, you know, pretty bottoms, ugly bottoms. I guess they're sick of listening to it. I think bottom's well described in the big book with the 4 horsemen. And if that don't get it, it's pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. That's it. I believe it's when you arrive at that place, when you know you've divorced yourself from man and God, and you can't stand to look at yourself in the mirror. You know, you look at you and you say, my God, it's you again. And you've hurt those people you love so much. You just keep hurting them. Just keep hurting them. And the truth can't be found in you. Can't be found in you at all. You don't even know what the truth looks like. And you've been robbed of your dreams. And it's bottom. That's bottom. And I don't care whether that happens in a condominium or under a bridge somewhere. Everybody's got a Kenmore box. And I believe that's the Kenmore box right there. So, anyhow, I pursued this thing. God had a sponsor. Started on the steps. And was fairly successful, told the usual lies, you know, went to a lot of meetings and tried to put everything together. You know, we want to get caught up and catching up right away, you know. Of course, I tried that too. I didn't see why I couldn't have it all back together in a month or two. And by 6 weeks, hell, I had my teeth fixed in a Timex. I thought I would join the holy men. That's about the time we ran into Charles. We found out different. But the thing is that I really believe in this thing of dreams. The steps take care of the relationships, you know, the broken relationships, the debt, and trying to make us an honest person and all these other things that they're so well designed to do. And they do a good job of it if we'll make the application of it. But the dreams are something else. That's something that we have to take care of ourselves. Years ago, they used to make a dream list or a wish list, they called it. And I'm very sincere about this, ladies and gentlemen. I'll tell you right now, you can sit down and make your wish list out if you want to, and make an honest application of these 12 steps for 1 year. And I guarantee you, you will have gotten the things on the list, or you will have gotten a Ford pickup instead of a Cadillac because you needed the Ford to work out of. But more importantly yet, you will find you've been granted more than what was on the list. Guarantee it. Try it. It works. I don't have a dream that hadn't been fulfilled since I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I told you I was uneducated, and I certainly was. And that was the most embarrassing thing in my life. I hated to be asked about my education. Of course, as long as I was drunk, it didn't make any difference. I'd lie to you. I tell you as a brain surgeon or anything else, you know. But it made a difference once I got sober, you know. And so one of the old man that slept upstairs down at Central, old man Bill, he was a Harvard grad. Now, he wasn't a janitor or anything. He just slept upstairs. And he used to always do me that way, you know. And he says, come here, dummy. I said, what do you want? He says, I want you to do something about the education thing. I want you to shut up about it. And I sang our national anthem. I says, but you don't understand. And he says, what don't I understand? I says, I don't even have a high school diploma. He says, good, dummy, that's where you start. Three things you can remember about alcoholics, don't care who he is. He always wants to be rewarded for not robbing the bank. He's the best in the world at mind reading and fortune telling. And he always wants to start from where he ain't. Always wants to start from where he ain't. And I wasn't any different. So I had to go take that test down there, and they gave me a certificate, and I went out to the university, Rude Awakening. It takes 4 years to get a degree down there at that university. And I have one in art, need 14, 16 hours degree in sociology. Don't want it, but the dream's been fulfilled. I wanted to be an auctioneer. I am an auctioneer, been one for years. And I don't practice it anymore, but I can still do. I did a few charity things every now and then. But I wanted to own some antique shop. I want a antique shop. And I think I'm up to 9 or 10 now. And lost money in every damn one of them. But the dream's been fulfilled. He didn't say that, you know, I'm going to see you prosper in any of these things, Oakley. You know, he says, I think that the God of my understanding is to assure me that I don't get defeated by my problems. He doesn't say you're not going to have any problems, Oakley. He says, you're just not going to get defeated by them anymore. So I'm still messing with antiques and still losing money. But the other thing was, when I was just a small child, we went down on the Kentucky River. They stole a carnival-sized tent someplace, and they partitioned it off and all that. And it was right there on that beautiful white sand they had on certain parts of the Kentucky River. Summertime, of course, it was beautiful. And I'd sit down on that soft sand at night and could hear and see that water, you know, as it went by, and it just calmed me right down. Nobody'd be hollering at me or beating on me or kicking on me or nothing like that, you know, and I'd just go like that. So I determined right then that sometime I was going to have a house on the water somewhere. And, of course, it's pretty hard to get a loan for a house when you're sucking on a wine jug. So naturally it didn't come about until I joined hands with this silent influence. And Al Vernon and I was taking a crippled lady to meetings with us. Whenever she wanted to go, we'd always call her and tell her where she was going. And she wanted to go, we'd go pick her. Anyhow, this one night we were telling her we had to move because the landlady had sold the house. And she says, why don't you see so-and-so? They want to sell their house. And I says, because I don't have any money. I just quick deeded the only house I ever had. And I had no money, and I didn't think I had any more GI Bill or anything like that. My wife then says, I'll go talk to them. And the deal was she needed a few $1,000 up front, and she wanted to hold the paper herself so I didn't have to worry about having any real money or not. But you know where the place was? It was on a little lake down in South Orlando. And I just loved it there. I I raised ducks and turned them loose there on the lake, you know, and I fed the fishing and birds and everything. And really and truly love. You say, well, you live down at Narcoosee now. Incidentally, those of you, a few of you might have been to Narcoosee. If he was, he's probably lost. But I live down at Narcoosee now. Well, that was the wife's deal. There's 12 and a half acres down there. It's got a nice barn on. She wanted to raise birds and all that sort of thing. So sure enough, I had to give up my lake and everything and my birds and my ducks up there. But you see, down in Narcoosee or down in Osceola County, if you got any kind of spread at all, well, you can dig a hole in the ground and call it a cattle hole, and nobody says anything about it. So I got a cattle hole down there that covers about a quarter of an acre or so. So I got my water again, and I can get to watch it anytime I want to. So if you have any dreams, bring your dreams to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Bring your drunken dreams to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And sit down with that sponsor. And for God's sakes, get a sponsor. Those of you who don't have a sponsor, get one. And for God's sakes, get one that's got one. Because if you don't, you're listening to two damn fools, you and him. But bring those drunken dreams to the rooms of alcoholics. Get with this sponsor. Weed out that. You know, chances are you're not going to be the CEO of General Motors or something like that. Get the trash out of there. But those things that can be of some validity and all, leave them on there and try for them. They'll work. They'll work. So you bring your dreams to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And traveling around, I get upset about some of the things I see and hear in meetings around the country and all. And it is. It's terribly upsetting to me. It's simple things as the third step. Because I talk to somebody and I listen close and I say, afterwards over with, I say, where are you at in the steps? Well, I'm on the third step. And I said, well, honey, you can't be on the third step. You know, God either is or ain't. But you can't be on the third step. Well, that's what my sponsor says. I said, well, you better go read the book then, because you can't be on the third step. And if you are, let me tell you this. You got just enough of God not to be crazy and just enough of AA not to be drunk. And that's a damn dangerous place to be. And how in the world the sponsors can let people do that, I don't know. I hope I'm not hurting anybody's feelings, but these steps are meant to work. Incidentally, none of you want me for a sponsor because I believe you get the steps done in 2 weeks. I don't see any reason going any longer than that. Because if I understand the book at all, you're supposed to shake hands with a God of your understanding. He's going to help you with your problem, not Bill Oakley. Mm-mm. I don't want you to put your dependence on me. So my job is to take you through those steps with the limited knowledge I have about them. Whether you even speak to me again after that's over, I don't care. Uh-uh. Most people do. I've got guys I've had 17, 18 years now. But that's not absolutely necessary. The necessary thing for me to do is to provide you with what education I have on these steps and to help you through them. And have you make that arrangement with the God of your understanding. And I believe this about the third step, too. You've got to be out of your mind to seek God. And let that one soak for a minute, and I'll give you this one. That God's coming to man is God's business. I hear these people say, well, you think they captured God or something, or they found him somewhere, you know? Uh-uh. It's like the rooster, you know, he crows in the morning, and he thinks he created the dawn. No, he just announced it. It don't make any difference what the rooster thinks. He just announced it. He did not create the dawn. And so it is with man and God. God comes to man in God's time. And we merely make ourselves receptacles, willing and open receptacles for God. So my job is to put you in that position, or to help you get in that position, where you're willing to receive a God of your understanding who's going to help you solve your problems. And again, I certainly hope that you don't ask Bill Oakley to solve your problem. My God, I'd be the very worst in the world. I had a kid call me up one time, asked me about his employment, and the wife heard me talking to him. She says, what are you talking to him about? Or who are you talking to? And I told her. She says, why in the world would he call you about work? You haven't worked in 3 years. There is an awful lot in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous that just tears me apart because it's so simple. That book was written at an 8th or 9th grade level. I know that's college level today, but if you get about a 1936 or 38 dictionary, you'll find it real easy to understand, you know. Because we go from immediately to the third step to the fourth step. The most missed word in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, is when you open the page to the inventory and it's got the things and it says, I'm resentful at Mr. Jones because of his wife, so forth and so on. Right over his very column over here on the left, it says, I am resentful at. Doesn't say I was or I'm going to be. It says I am. I am means now. So how do I take the inventory? I take the inventory with those things that bother me about me right now. And I go on and do a fifth step. You say, oh my God, I forgot some things. Of course you are. I talked to Liz about Charlie shortly before he died. Come to find out he still had some errors in his life and all. We're not going to be rid of these things. You're not going to run out of them. Or at least I haven't met anybody that's run out of the darn things yet. So that's how easy the inventory. Six or eight things. Put it down on a piece of paper and sit down and talk to somebody about them and go on with your life. You discover some more things as you go along. Of course you do. It's meant to be that way. Read the last paragraph in that chapter. What does it say? We have discovered some of the grosser handicaps. Doesn't say them all. It says grosser. Oh, those things that are really getting to me right now. That's what I need to be talking about. And the other thing that holds a lot of people back, I think I'm the only one that has ever done this. If it's got a name, it's been done before. And chances are you didn't assign that nomenclature. And then finally in the fifth step, the one thing that I know for sure, the old boy up in Indiana used to do fifth steps. They tell me he was a powerhouse at it too. And he used to just take them out on his front porch and he had two chairs there and he'd put a rocker over here. And he'd start talking to the kid and as soon as he found out he's lying, he'd hit that rocker and make it rock. And he says, who's coming to sit in there? He said, you wouldn't God stand up, would you? So he'd lie a little more and hit that rocker and rock back and forth, you know. Pretty soon, the kid stopped lying. You might try that. Because we like to lie on these things. You know, sometimes my deeds get better as I tell them and all. But in any event, we go to the fifth step. And, of course, here we're not going to tell all this. I can't tell this. I never depart with this. And sure enough, it's some immature, minor sexual activity that happened between either two people, of course, but maybe one. But and we're so ashamed of it. I know a boy in Orlando who's 37 years old now. Cannot walk in a room where his aunt is at because she's 9 years older than he is. And they had a little thing when he was a little boy and she was a little girl. Little innocent thing. Wasn't something that was planned for. It wasn't malicious. It didn't harm anybody or anything like that. So those are the things we have to look for in fifth step. I said the arrangement with God is the essential thing. Of course it is. I don't have any argument there, and I know you don't either. But there's also this need of a human voice. So I say when I take them through the steps, I don't care whether they speak to me or not. I really don't. But I certainly insist upon them having one person in their life at least that they can turn to. God loves you, and he's going to talk to you and tell you or offer you to do things in one thing and another. But you better have that human voice. You can talk to it 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning when you're coming unglued and things are just not going right for you. I'm going to go into the rest of the steps because it takes the rest of the evening. But I do think that we're making a tremendous mistake in not taking the people right on through the steps. And if you read the book, that's the way it's set up. We have people not getting sponsors. I can't see why anybody wouldn't want a sponsor. It improves your own. You have to take them through the steps. So that makes you improve your own situation each time you do that. And it's so rewarding. I had one at Central one time. I love to tell this story. His name was Richard. He was a basket case and the worst young drunk I think I ever saw. I mean, he was just out of it already and real young. And so he was the kind of guy, I'd get ready to take him to a meeting. I say, Richard, don't you think you ought to go to the bathroom? He said, I don't know. What do you think? I say, for God's sake, go to the bathroom, Richard. And he'd come out and be just grinning. He says, you're right. And I did. I prayed a lot over Richard that God would do something about it. And sure enough, he had a sister out in California, and she found out about him and sent for him. And I thought, thank you, God. About 5 or 6 years later, I'm in a meeting at Central, and I looked over across the room, and I said, Jesus, I know that guy. I know that guy. And The meeting was over and he came walking towards me. He says, "You know who I am?" I says, "I do now. You're Richard, aren't you?" He says, "Yeah." Clancy got a hold of him out there. He'd been sober the whole time he'd been out there. He had a job. He came across the country on a bus because he wanted to see the country, not because he didn't have money, because he had a checkbook. And I thought, Lord, Lord. So see, we aren't there to get them all, you know. Sometimes we just need to look around. Maybe somebody else can do the job a hell of a lot better than we can. The only thing I know about that for sure, and that's when we go about these things, that I have better go with the Word of God instead of thinking I can save this guy. If I go as the Savior, it won't be a success, I can assure you. But if I will go with Him and ask His guidance in these things, it'll be all right. And I'm quite sure that's the way it was meant for Richard. I don't have any problem with that. But people refuse to sponsor anymore. I hear people with long years in the program say, "I never sponsored anybody." I can't understand that, because it is such a rewarding thing. It has to make you grow. It teaches you so many things about people. And to see them change and the results of some of the things that they've accomplished in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is absolutely wonderful. And I told somebody the other night a thing that showed you that we don't have any real influence on some of these things. We just need to say them. And the person that needs them, he gets them. I was up in Maryland at the state convention 2 years ago and was through speaking. You know, well, they shake your hand, do a lot of things, thank you for coming, all that sort of thing. And there was a young man standing there behind me. He wasn't in the line, and he was sort of twitching and carrying on. And I turned, and I said, "You want to see me?" And he says, "Yes." And he says, "About 10 or 12 years ago, I don't know exactly when, I heard you make a talk down in Orlando or down in Florida, and you kept hitting on that thing, 'You can't start from where you ain't.' He says, 'You hit on it two or three times.' And he says, 'I always wanted to be a CPA, but was always in some dead-end job. Just couldn't make it.' And he says, I made up my mind that the next day I was going to make some contribution towards becoming a CPA. Whatever it was, some step towards becoming a CPA. So he says, I just wanted you to know that I'm a CPA today." I says, "I'm delighted that you told me that story." Now, I didn't have a thing in the world to do with that. What I did was tell him something that Charlie Lindenwood had told me. You can't start from where you ain't. So we go. Sometimes you don't even need to say something. Just be there. Your presence is enough for these people. But we need to make our presence. And especially in this area of sponsorship, we are doing a lousy job. We really are. And it starts with the groups, ladies and gentlemen. We can't go to New York. New York don't want to talk about it anyhow. But we need to look at our own houses and start taking care of things. It's a reward you don't want to miss. It's like this kid was riding a tricycle down through the park. And a preacher was sitting over reading his Bible. And the kid hit a crack on the sidewalk there and hit over elbows, he went. Tore his pants, you know, bruised his knee real bad. And he looked at his tricycle wheel and it was all out of line. Knew he couldn't ride it. He says, "I'll be a son of a bitch." And the preacher come off the bench there and he says, "Son, don't ever say anything like that. When bad things happen to you, you say, 'Praise God.'" 2 weeks later, same scenario. Kid comes down through the park there on his tricycle. The preacher's there in the afternoon reading his Bible. And sure enough, boom, he hits the crack. Head over elbows, torn pants, bruised knee, wheel of his tricycle all out of line. And he says, "I'll be a..." He says, "Praise God." And he looked down. Pants wasn't torn. There wasn't any bruise on his knee. And his tricycle wheel was just straight as a die. And he got on and went riding down through the park. And the preacher come off the bench and says, "I'll be a son of a bitch." Try it, please. There's a Richard that needs you too. Believe me, there is. There always is. We're so afraid, it seems like, that we're afraid to say anything to anybody. But again, if I ask God to help me, when I maybe want to help a new person or see a new person come into the room, it'll be a success. Only if I go as a saver will it fail. So if I've only been here 2 days and I see that guy come through there and he's a little jumpy in one thing or another, I can at least go over and put my hand on him or my arm out and say, "Welcome. I don't know anything about this. I've only been here 2 days, but these people seem to have something. Let me take you over here and introduce you to Tom. He's been around a long time." We can at least do that. Because I'll guarantee you, if I ask everybody in this room, I know what brought you to your first meeting, I'm not concerned about that. If I ask you what brought you to the second meeting, you would tell me, "Somebody put their arm around my shoulder, somebody shook my hand, somebody gave me a
phone number. If somebody says, please come back. That's why I came to the second meeting. But we're not doing that. We do something like this. Is anybody here for their first meeting? Just give your first name, please. My name's John. Welcome, John. Get some phone numbers, John. Come back, John. And the meeting's over. John walks out the door and we get in our little cliques. And nobody talks to John. It's a damn shame, but it's happening. It happens more than it should. I don't know why we're so afraid to stop John and say something to him. How could he possibly harm us? God's going to give you the little voice that you need. You have nothing to fear from that. Everybody in this room, he'll provide with that little voice. And all you got to do is use it. This guy was robbing a safe. He had a pen light. And he was working with a safe, you know, that small light. And he heard a little voice. And the little voice says, Jesus sees you. And he says, my God, what's that? But he knew he didn't have much time. And he went right back to work on the safe, you know. And the little voice says again, Jesus doesn't like what you're doing. So this time he stopped. And he took his arm and extended the light as far as he could. But he couldn't see all the way around the room. But he still didn't see anything. So he went back to work on the safe, you know. And the little voice says, Jesus will punish you. So he stopped now and he walked around the room all the way around. Finally got over here in the corner. And there stood a little old green bird on a perch. And he says, oh hell, what could a little old green bird do? But as his light fell away, there was a huge Doberman with his ears pointed up and his teeth blared. And the little voice says, sick him, Jesus. We're over time. No, really. We do need to do these things a little better than we are, folks. I just tell them, Ben, this is the first time I've been without a sponsee, a young sponsee, you know, that hadn't been around a few years. In a long time, I'm going to have to find me one because I get a little out of sorts when I don't have one to work with and make some kind of commitment to and all. So think about that and just remember, just ask God to help you because you're really about His business anyhow. You're not about your business. You're about His business to start with. It's one of His children. And that's exactly why I think you should take the steps, too, to get into His business. So this has been a real fine time. It's been an exciting time. What problem did I have in the early days? Many of them. The same as you have had, probably. One that was hard to shed? I had a small God. You need a big God. Don't get a little one. Because, see, God was just, I'd ask for something, I'd get it, and then I'd cuss because it was a small amount. And he's saying, well, you brought the thimble. You could just easily have brought a bucket. I don't care. I can fill a bucket just as easy as I can a thimble. So get a big God. Get a God that's got a sense of humor. And I told this over at the round table the other night. My wife had been working some antique shows, and I was ready to come up to Mount Dora to work flea market. And I had already loaded out the night before, but when I came out of the house that morning, I looked over there and I saw the cases that she had been using to display in. You know, and they'd fold up and stack the stuff in them, all that sort of thing. And so we'd already determined to get rid of them. And so I looked up and I said, remember, God, I don't want to bring these things home. So I threw them on the truck with my junk. And so I wheeled up to Mount Dora there and went into my space and walked around the back of the truck and busted out laughing. They'd blown off on the way up there. Yeah. If he hadn't got a sense of humor, chances are he ain't God. But this has been a rewarding time. God, the people in my life. That's the only time people ask me, says, you get a little nervous before you get up there? Yes, I do. I sit over there and I think of that whole host of men and women that helped Bill Oakley walk to this podium tonight. God, so many of them over the years. And of course, most recently, and the one most difficult for me to add to that list was Charlie Lindenwood, who was a very dear friend and a mentor for some years. But a whole host of people have helped this fool walk up here tonight. And they're willing to help you too. So it's been an exciting time. It's been a rewarding time. There's a lot of freedom in my life today. There's a richness in my life today. And I think the IRS is just ready to clean me out. But there's still a richness in my life. There's a lot of hope. There's new dreams. There's a excitement of God. But do you know, with all the love, the beauty, the excitement of God, the challenge of that new tomorrow, it'll all be taken away with a single drink. Thank you.